welcome to the People Who Read People podcast, hosted by me, Zachary Elwood. This is a podcast aimed at better understanding other people and better understanding ourselves. You can learn more about it at behavior-podcast.com. If you enjoy this podcast, please share it with your friends and family. Helping me get more listeners is the main way you can encourage me to do more work on this podcast. Thanks for that. Today I talked to Larry Hart, who's a Division I college football coach at the University of Houston and the author of the book, The Recruit's Playbook, a four-year guide to college football recruitment for high school athletes. I talked to Larry about reading and predicting behavior in football. We talk about some specific tells that are sometimes used to get an edge on opponent players and teams. And just to clarify for any international listeners, just in case, we're talking about American football here, not soccer. Larry and I also talk about the importance of reviewing footage of past football games and of specific players, and how big a role analyzing behavior plays in football in general. We also talk about trying to read coaches in terms of the signals they give the players and the formation patterns they choose. We talk about the mental stress of competitive sports, especially for young people. We talk about the risk of going on tilt when things go badly. We talk about the challenges of recruiting and the softer skills involved in trying to predict how young players will perform. If you like this talk, you might also enjoy some earlier talks I had that were also sports-focused. In a previous episode, I talked to John Hoffling, a sports analyst and broadcaster, about reading tells in football and other sports. In another episode, I talked with well-known tennis coach Carlos Goffi about reading behaviors in tennis. A little more about my guest, Larry Hart. He has over a decade of firsthand knowledge of football. He's an All-American college athlete, an alumni NFL draft pick, and currently an outside linebackers coach at University of Houston. He also has a master's degree in communication studies. You can check out his book, The Recruit's Playbook, on Amazon and other booksellers. You can also follow him on Twitter at Coach Larry Hart. That's H-A-R-T. Okay, here's the talk with Larry Hart. Hey, Larry, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Zach. I'm fired up to be on your show this morning.
Thank you. Appreciate it. All right, let's start with maybe a good place to start would be one episode I did for my podcast was about the Ben Roethlisberger tell that got some attention a couple years ago. And maybe we could start with your opinion on that whole Ben Roethlisberger foot indicator story and talk about maybe how common such things are in the football world.
First off, I thought the article was really, really cool, talking about his foot, and every time it was aligned a certain way, it indicated whether it was pass or not, or pass versus run. So those things like that are actually really common in football, and because football is such a sport of habit and things kind of are so repetitive and you get into such a routine in football. So sometimes they kind of go unnoticed. And football is so unique, and it's such an art to it, because to be really a really effective football player, you have to get in a rhythm, you have to get in a routine. And so within the game itself, sometimes things like that kind of go unnoticed because players are such a creature of habit. And so, yeah, they show up a lot, you know. So from week to week game planning as a football coach, you'll see where sometimes offensive linemen, they'll tip run or pass, or sometimes quarterbacks will touch their towels when they're getting ready to throw the football, because they know, like, hey, I got to be accurate here. O-linemen, they'll stagger their stance a little bit more. They'll lean forward when it's run, or they'll stagger their stance when it's passed. And so I think when it comes to preparation and film study as football coaches, it's a really cool deal to see things like that and notice that on film. And sometimes you can translate that information over to the players, which can give you an advantage. And I know just weekly in our preparation for opponents, you know, that's something that I actually look for every week. And I study, you know, hours of film trying to give us an edge on our opponent. Because if we know it's run or pass, that helps us out a lot as defensive coaches, because a lot of what we do is reactionary. We don't know what the opponent's going to do as defensive coaches. So we look for any advantage that we can from our opponent that we're going to go against. Is his eyes looking a certain way, or his head pointed in a certain direction? what's his demeanor here, you know, on certain plays and certain things that they do to give you any tip or any advantage. You know, those are things that we look for as football coaches all the time. We read body language. We read stances, alignments, any little thing that you can think of to give us an advantage. We do that.
That was one thing I wondered about the Roethlisberger story was it seemed like it got a lot of attention, but I kind of wondered, do teams have a motivation to not talk about that stuff and keep that knowledge secret? And if it is more common like that, was it just that particular thing got out in the mainstream, but there's other things like that teams just don't let out in the wild that much?
Especially in the NFL, I wouldn't think they would want that information to get out, because more than likely, if you're Pittsburgh, they play the same opponents twice in a season. Okay, so they're going to play the Ravens, they're going to play the Browns, and they're going to play the Bengals twice each season, and they're going to play those guys. I mean, every year. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're in the same division, so I wouldn't want that information to get out because mm-hmm. because I'm like, I want to keep using this information week in and week out.
Right. When it gets out, you can't use it. Yeah.
Yeah. No question. So it's certain things that you know, hey, if it helped us win this time, I definitely don't want that information to keep getting out or get out so he could potentially change that, you know, because especially like in the NFL or, well, even in college now, man, the margin for error or the margin to win is so small. I mean, every game is competitive. Every game is tough. Just last night, you look at Virginia Tech and NC State. I mean, NC State came in as a big time favorite and they only won by 1 point, you know? So any given Saturday, you know, you can lose a ball game. So you're looking for an edge to win all the time.
Right. In that case, in that Roethlisberger case, that was a fan, but somebody who was trying to be a Theo Ash was his name. He was not on the teams or anything. He was just somebody who does analysis, his own analysis. And so that made sense why he would be the one to out that, because there's that could theoretically be something other teams knew, but just nobody would talk about publicly kind of thing. Right.
Absolutely. That is 100% correct.
I've often wondered how much do teams study game tape, and maybe you could talk a little bit about that and how much of that study is about reading actual behaviors versus, you know, studying the non-behavioral, just basic strategies and decisions of players.
Yeah, I would say, you know, everybody has roles as coaches. So on a staff, obviously, you know, I work with the defensive front. So you're primarily going to be studying kind of one section of the game plan. So we kind of break it down because you have a full staff of guys. We have probably about 9 guys on the defensive staff. So everybody on the staff has a specific role that they kind of hone in on. And we all kind of bring it together. And obviously the defensive coordinator puts together the whole plan. So, you know, with my role, I'll watch some of the front stuff, but then I'll specifically look at behaviors or I'll look specifically at players. Man, I'll spend, you know, a good amount of time. I'll probably say within a week, I'll spend about 6 hours just trying to study, you know, behaviors. Or when I say behaviors, looking at their body language, looking at certain things on film, trying to find a consistency to know one thing in particular, run, pass, or if I can find some kind of tip on a particular play.
That was one thing you emphasized in your book, was the importance of studying the game tape as one thing you could do to, you know, really advance your football knowledge and wisdom. And I'm curious, is a lot of it when you're studying the game tape, is most of it studying the team and players that you're playing next? Am I getting that right?
Yeah. So we play the University of South Florida tomorrow. And we played Navy last Saturday. So as soon as we get done playing Navy last Saturday, we'll come in Sunday the next day. We'll kind of finish up watching the last game, if we need to make any adjustments, blah, blah, blah. But when Sunday evening, probably around 3 or 4 o'clock, that's kind of where we transition fully on to South Florida. So we'll go from midday Sunday all the way up to this point now, Friday, you know, just completely focusing on South Florida and watching that opponent, putting in hours upon hours of film study to get ready for those guys.
Mm-hmm. I was reading an article a few days ago. It was about studying game tape. And one of the things they mentioned was watching a fullback who would kind of telegraph where he was going to go based on his eye direction, you know, where he was watching. And that gave the opponents a huge edge. They would just run wherever he was looking. And you had mentioned that too, talking about where players look. Is that, am I understanding that's a big source of behavioral tells, is just where people look?
Yeah, 100%. That's a big one, man. It really is. You know, like I said, football players are a creature of habit, and they get into rhythm and they get into habits, and yeah, they will tip some things. And there has been opponents this week, I mean, not this week, but this year, I'm sorry, that will tip, whether it's run or pass. You know, old linemen will do it. Running backs will be looking in a certain direction. I mean, sometimes the running backs will look where, okay, this pass pro, and they got to help in the protection, and they'll be looking at the guy that they have. Or they'll be, you know, based on their demeanor, they know that they're about to get the ball, and so they'll be kind of looking in the direction of the run. So, yeah, I mean, those things are those things are very common. And those are things that we do look for, is just looking at demeanor and stances and things like that. I mean, that is it's very common in football, man. And it's really interesting to talk about it. But those are some of the things that we look for. One of the things that we do is we don't want opponents to know. So we will yell it verbally on film. You know, well, we'll yell it verbally on the field, but we won't ever give a point. We won't ever do anything with our hands. So that's one thing that we'll do, is we'll yell it out there on the field, but we don't want to put it on film to let opponents know that we have a tip on them. Okay. So we have a certain word that we use for pass, and I won't tell you what that is, but
tell us all your secrets.
I know, right? So we have a certain word that we use, and just say if it's north, 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 north. So we'll yell it, but we won't point, because if we point and every time we point in the sky, our opponents will see that. And so they'll be like, man, what do those guys know? So we'll say it, and then you'll see players kind of, adjust their alignments to get in a better pass stance, and then we'll go get after the quarterback.
Yeah, it makes sense that there'd be so many behavioral patterns, you know, like the stance you were talking about. That was Roethlisberger's thing, where it was like whether his foot was off the ground, and it makes sense that there'd be those kind of indications, you know, just getting ready for a specific play, one play or another. Yeah,
man, absolutely. You know, really, I think that the old lineman, I more times than not give it away a lot. And I think it's very difficult for those guys sometimes to hide it, because if it's run, you can just look at their base, right? A lot of times their feet will be slightly wider when it's run, because they got to kind of shift their weight, and they got to be able to get ready to move a 300-pound guy. When it's pass, a lot of times those guys are kind of get their stance a little bit more narrow, and they'll kind of elevate their pad level a little bit, because now they got to get ready to go backwards and get out of their stance, because you got a really fast guy coming off the edge. So those things, man, guys, I think when you start getting into the flow of the game and they're not thinking about, well, let me not tip, run, or pass, they're thinking about, man, I just got to get my job done, because I mean, this dude here is really freaking fast. That's coming after the quarterback, you know, and I got to get ready to stop it, you know?
Right. Yeah. It seems like there's only so much, you know, even if you knew you were theoretically giving a little bit away in the heat of the battle, it's like, you got to do what you have to do in a quick way. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But besides the eye direction, looking where people are going to go, and the behavioral, like the body posture stance and base and feet and such, are those the main things you would say as far as the main patterns people look for?
And also, you know, I think coaches have patterns, So there will be certain formations that coaches will align in that they will primarily throw the ball out of. And we've seen that. So we're like, man, as you watch film, you watch film in patterns, by the way. You watch film in certain formation, backfield sets, and plays. So you input data into a system, and then you break your film down by watching all the same formation, backfield sets, plays. You watch all those things in order. And then you kind of break it down by situations, like down and distance, all that stuff. And so as you watch film in sequence and in order and in a certain flow, and then when some kind of pops out, like, well, then when you watch all the run game out of these certain formations, and then you get to another formation, you're like, these guys, every time they line in this formation, they throw the ball, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's an indication of that the offensive coordinator has a pattern, okay? And so, and then you're able to relay to the kids, you're like, hey, if they line up here and that back is aligned here, it's freaking 90% that, hey, it's going to be pass, okay? Mm. Whatever that code word is, and the players, and they see it, and they be like, hey, it's freaking pass. And then, hey, we're going to that's also a tip that we'll use.
Mm-hmm. One thing I wondered, with so much on the line in these games, do they ever bring in outside like behavior experts, or is it more just, you know, they use the people with the football knowledge? I could see it kind of going either way.
Yeah, they primarily use coaches they use the coaches that's on staff, because I think that we kind of know, you know, I tell you, it'd probably be interesting to bring in somebody from the outside, but we primarily use the guys that are here that's on the staff. And, you know, that may be actually pretty interesting, Zach, to bring in an outside person, because they may find some things that, you know, we may not necessarily look for, you know. Mm-hmm.
That's what I was kind of wondering. It'd be like, you know, because when you're close to something, it can be hard to come in with fresh eyes. And I kind of wondered if that sometimes happened.
Yeah, I think that would be interesting, because sometimes people that have knowledge of behavior may see certain things that we don't see, you know, is a guy rubbing his leg or rubbing his towel? Is he, you know, getting on pass plays? Is he getting antsy prior to the film, you know, on the film, you know? So there may be certain tips that a behavior specialist could pull out.
What about false tells? Do players, you know, being aware of how much they're being watched, is there ever a case of people doing a false indicator of what they're going to do to throw the other team off, and how common is that?
Yeah. I know offensive coaches, or I think even, I mean, all coaches, I think they have a tendency to do that. So it's common in football that after about 4 or 5 weeks of playing, or when you get to your bye week, coaches will do what's called a self-scout. So they'll do a breakdown on themselves and see what they've kind of done. And they'll kind of find certain patterns that they do. And then they'll go out there that next week and they'll try to break those patterns, so to speak. Mm. You know, so there is a coaches will do that. But I think just sometimes if you get into a rhythm where you're playing games weekly, back to back to back to back, a lot of times it's difficult to put in that time to self-scout yourself, because so much of your energy is going to that opponent. A lot of times it comes during your bye week when you have extra time.
In talking before this, you had talked about the signal stealing in football, which also happens in other sports and in baseball and such. And maybe you could explain what that is, especially for a non-football audience, what that involves.
Yeah. So the communication between the football players and the coaching staff, so they have to communicate to the players what play that the coaches want to run on that particular down. So, I mean, obviously you got four downs to get a first down. Most people punt on fourth down. So in those first three downs, the coaches have to tell the players, like, hey, we're going to run inside zone left out of this formation. So they communicate through signals. So somebody may tap their head, and they tap their head, point at their eyes, and flex their muscles or whatever. Mm-hmm. So they'll give these different signals to tell what the play is going to be. And again, based upon just different patterns that coaches have that they call that, you know, most coaches have the same plays that they run over and over again. And what you can do, and I know this is popular with coaches across America, that they'll look at the so you have your regular film that you have on your system, but then you also have a TV copy of the game. And so you'll look at that TV copy, and then, you know, oftentimes on that TV copy, they'll have the sideline and the coaches that are signaling. And so if you like, you can put in a lot of time just watching the offensive sideline and watching the signal guys signal something in, and then you'll watch the play actually being ran. And so if you do that long enough, you'll kind of pick up on a pattern between their signals and what they're actually running. And so, and then you get to the game day, you're like, man, I've seen that signal before. When they did this signal, it was this particular pass play. So, and that can potentially give you an advantage there. And so that's why you'll see some people have, you know, they'll use these drapes and they'll use all these different things to try to cover up their signals. And you'll have three or four signal guys to make it difficult on the opponents. So it is a pretty common deal in college football. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one interesting thing about that is it seemed like it was kind of thought of as a little bit underhanded, so people wouldn't talk about that it was a thing, and the same in baseball too. But it also seems like it's not surprising at all, considering how high stakes these games are, that you would try to get every advantage possible. So do you have a sense of how underhanded is it viewed to do that versus, you know, is it just common knowledge that everybody does it and it's just outside of the game that it's viewed as underhanded?
I think within college football, I think everybody knows that there is a potential for signal stealing. And I think the signal stealing is not as big of a deal, like in terms of it's being viewed as, oh, you're a big time cheater. You know, people in college football don't view it that way. They view it as, okay, we're going to do as good of a job we can kind of hiding who's signaling, whatever the case may be. And you also have these other set of coaches, like, you know, if you put in that much time trying to steal our signals, if you're going to dedicate that much time, then that's going to actually take time away from preparation. And we don't really care anyway, because you got to go out there and execute. Mm-hmm. So kind of coaches fall in that kind of a mindset. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It reminds me of there's in poker that, you know, there's what they call angle shooting, which is a word for doing something that's perceived as a bit underhanded, but it's definitely a gray area, because, you know, everybody knows that when you're playing poker or most really competitive games, you're trying to get every edge. So it's kind of on you to watch out for those things, even if you think they're a little bit underhanded. And it probably is similar in most games. Yeah.
I got a quick question, Zach. So now, and I've been kind of curious about this, in poker, is there, and you know that there's a lot of money in the pot, does the pressure kind of increase on the poker player to maintain his composure if he knows he's got a good hand or he's trying to bluff or whatever the case may be? As the game kind of builds, is there pressure on the player?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, I think that's one of the key things I talk about in my Poker Tales book, is these situational categories, because as the pot gets bigger, as you say, like as the stakes basically ramp up, especially in No Limit, you know, where the amount you bet actually gets bigger usually. Typically, you know, you're usually betting much bigger on the river, sometimes even all in. So yeah, the emotional categories can be very different. And sometimes early in a hand, when the stakes are low, the tells you'll find are just much different, because they're usually tells of more like, well, is somebody mentally focused or not? Whereas like later in a hand, when somebody's betting, everybody's focused because there's so much money in the pot and so much at stake. So the tells aren't really about lack of focus or focus or these kinds of things. They're more about, is somebody betting, and is there indicators of them either being relaxed with a strong hand or nervous with a bluff, you know? So it becomes more polarized. But yeah, it's a great question. I feel like that's a very important point about poker, is how the stakes change the emotional factors. Yeah.
Right. Gotcha.
One other thing I wondered was, do teams ever use lip reading? Because I've read about a little bit of paranoia on coaches' parts, like covering their mouths when they're talking to players and stuff like that.
Yeah. I will say this now, the coaches can be very, very paranoid. You know, you'll have a limited amount of people that can come to practice. And now that is, in college football, that is very underhanded thing. If you have people that'll actually come to somebody's practice and video somebody's practice. Now that is a very underhanded, and that will in college football get somebody very upset. But yeah, coaches have a tendency to be very paranoid, and their playbook sheets, and you know, when they're out there calling plays, they do cover their mouth. Now, I don't think that people are really, I don't think that's a thing where people look at the mouth reading and all that stuff, but that is something that coaches are, there is some paranoia that goes on with coaches, man, for sure.
Yeah, I'd imagine it's like, even if you think it's a very slim possibility, it's like, well, you might as well do a few extra things just to make sure. Yeah.
No question. No doubt about it. No doubt about it.
So before we move on to, I was going to ask some questions about recruiting, but do you have anything else you want to talk about anything major we didn't discuss about reading, predicting players on the field?
Well, I was interested to think about just talking about the pressure, you know, as the game kind of continues on in college football. I think there is something to be said about like when the game kind of builds and it's a tight game. I think there is an emotional factor there to where if the game is tight, then, you know, some guys perform better. And then when the game is tight, some guys kind of don't perform as well. Mm. And I wonder, and I was curious to think about this too, and I wonder if that's like in poker or, you know, I guess that's in other environments too. I would assume that as the game kind of gets tighter in poker, that some guys play better and then some guys can't hold their composure. And I think it's kind of similar like that in football. As the game kind of swells and gets tight, I wonder if players don't perform. Players sometimes don't perform as well when the mm-hmm. game's tight, right?
Yeah, and maybe they have like different – yeah, maybe they're more likely to leak some information in those high emotion spots.
No question.
Is that something – do you ever notice in reviewing game tape, is it ever something you notice where – something like this specific player doesn't perform well under pressure? Is that ever something noticed?
You know, I think really probably the position too. Yeah, I would say, yeah, I think quarterbacks show up a lot. I think, you know, there's certain players on the team, man, where if they in football, really, man, if you give up a big play, like if you're a DB and you give up a big play, because everybody can see you, you know, if you give up a long touchdown pass, whatever, I mean, that's pretty doggone embarrassing because everybody sees you. And this, it was a big moment in the game. I mean, I think that can now, I think you can see that player may change his, you know, his ability to perform as well, you know, mm-hmm. or perform really well. And I think, you know, in football, that is something that kind of shows up. Like if a quarterback throws an interception, you know, how is he going to come back that next drive and play? You know, mm-hmm. I think that is something with football is like momentum and the ability to handle adversity. Like if something bad happens, how are you able to come back off of that adversity? Because I mean, especially say if you're on the road and you throw an interception, the crowd is going crazy and they're yelling and screaming. The stadium is rocking. And then you got to be able to put that play behind you and then focus on the next play, you know? Mm-hmm. And I would imagine, you know, that may be similar to poker, man. Like you think that you have somebody and you're feeling good about yourself. And next thing you know, you know, he wins on the last card on something lucky and you're all angry about it and frustrated. And now, but you have to get your composure back and play the next play, so to speak.
Yeah, that's the, like they talk about in poker, tilt, which applies to, I think, every game. You know, if something bad happens to you, whether you make a mistake or just a random outcome. You know, that I think that's really what separates the very strong players in any field from the weaker players, is just the, how do you handle tilt? How do you handle getting emotionally upset? You know, can you continue playing your best, or does it send you down a landslide of playing bad?
You know? I'm curious, how did you handle that, Zach, when you play poker? How did you handle that?
That's a good question. I've actually written about that in my books, how I was actually not well suited to playing poker professionally, which was one of the reasons I didn't pursue it. You know, I always knew that I had a pretty anxious temperament. Like, I had anxiety and depression issues when I was young. And I always knew, you know, and that came out in my game too, because I didn't handle adversity very well. And that would have been something I really would have had to do a lot of self-work on to work through to become, you know, a high stakes poker player, which is, you know, one of the reasons I didn't really pursue it as a, you know, very long as a career, just because I think some people just are better suited. You know, in poker, they call it having alligator blood, where winning and losing doesn't really bug you. You know, you just maintain this neutral, stoic composure. And I definitely didn't have that. You know, it was something I got better on, you know, playing years after years, but it still was a problem for me. And I think that's, you know, that's common for a lot of people in any pursuit. You know, any competitive pursuit, it's how well do you handle the adversity, the downswings and such, you know?
Yeah. So is that something that you think can people develop that? Or is that something that you just have, right? Do you just have alligator blood, or is that something that you can develop?
Yeah, that's a big question. I might turn that back on you, because you probably have seen a lot more, you know, yeah, with the recruiting and seeing kids play and such, young people play. Do you feel like it's something you can develop?
You know, I think it's, man, it's really, that's a very interesting question. I think it is something that you can develop, like the mental toughness and all that. I do think it is something that you can develop. The key is, though, Zach, is, are you going to continue to put yourself out there to take those risks, though? You know, I think mentally it takes a lot for, if you're a person that struggles with anxiety, all that, because I did a little bit myself as a player. And so you're just kind of nervous, or you're unsure about things, but I just kind of continue to put myself out there, and sometimes you fall on your face and sometimes you're successful. And I don't know, I guess the bigger question is, are guys willing to continue to take those risks, you know? And are you willing to go out there and put yourself out there to either be the hero or to be the villain, or to fall on your face or to be successful? I mean, I think that's where the rubber meets the road. You can develop it. I just think that it's very difficult to continue to put yourself out there, so to speak.
Yeah, I think it's such a life challenge in general. Like, no matter what you do, it's like, how much do you continue doing things that make you uncomfortable? Because on one hand, it's like, doing things that make you uncomfortable is how you grow and how you get out of the discomfort. But on the other hand, if you're continually doing something that makes you uncomfortable, you know, there's always the question of, well, will this get easier? Are other people better suited at this than me, and I should just give up? You know, there's always this, and you talk a little bit about that in your book. It's like, there's no right answers. It comes down to a person's decisions and goals and feelings. And it's so hard to quantify these things, because yeah, some people are just going to have a much harder time than others. And kind of like the Rudy thing in football too, where it's like, well, should Rudy in that movie, should he have focused maybe on something else if he wasn't, you know, well suited to be a great athlete? You know, it always comes down to these really complex questions of like, how much you want it, how well suited you are to these things. Yeah.
Right. No doubt about it. No doubt about it.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about the recruiting, how much of recruiting is an art versus a science, and how much involves recognizing these kind of, you know, strong, does a kid have a strong character? Are they going to push through adversity? Those kinds of things.
Man, that is a really, really good question, because recruiting is, I mean, that's the lifeblood of your program. because you want kids that are, that obviously have the ability to play, but then you want kids that are mentally tough, that that's willing to go through some adversity and handle it the right way and just grow and mature and develop. When you're talking to kids and parents, I mean, you're analyzing everything, their background, you know, their family history, you know, their family background. You're talking to coaches, anybody that's connected with them. You want to try to gather up as much information on that particular recruit as possible, because you want to get a really good understanding of who you are, what individual you're bringing into your program, because I mean, that is your lifeblood. And so if you have a lot of good kids that have talent and they also have the right mental makeup, then you're probably going to have a good football team. But if you have kids that are a little immature and that really don't like to work, I mean, you're going to have a tougher time winning football games. So, but that also, I mean, it's recruiting is not just with players, it's with your coaching staff as well. And the people that you have around every day that's feeding into your program. So I think there's a lot of things that, that go into that. But anyway, but yeah, I talk a lot about that in my book and, you know, the Recruits Playbook. You know, I'm trying to help college students understand what they're walking into and how to grow and develop while they're in high school to be prepared for college football, because it is, college football is a challenge and it's very difficult. So, but yeah, for coaches, you have to do a really good job of evaluating who you're bringing into your program, and probably the behavior and the mental makeup is probably more important, or just as important, if not more, than the physical capabilities, for sure. Mm.
Yeah, one of the things you mentioned to me, I'm not sure if you talk about it in the book, but it was something you mentioned about young people being recruited and how they reacted to that, and whether they, you know, they might seem to want it too much, or versus you know, maybe the opposite side of the spectrum, which wouldn't be good either, would be not being that interested. And maybe you could talk a little bit about those kinds of indicators that, that let you know where someone's head is at.
There's a there's certain red flags or indicators that coaches look for. If you're reaching out to a kid on a consistent basis and he, you know, it may take him an hour or two to get back to you, but he does, he's always kind of consistent in his communication. You're like, okay, I think that there's, you know, there's genuine interest between me and him, and, you know, we like him, and, you know, okay, cool. So we'll kind of proceed forward in that that conversation. So what could be a red flag is, say, for instance, you look on the internet and this kid has 16 offers on his Twitter, and you know, he's got all these offers per se. But then, you know, this kid is constantly hitting you up 2 to 3 times a day. Mm. And you haven't really reached out to him. You're like, man, why is this dude hitting me up? That's kind of weird. That's kind of out of place. So that's like a red flag. You're like, man, what's going on there?
So he's acting like he's more desired than he seems to be. Yeah.
Well, it's like, you know, it's a couple things there. You know, it's like, okay, maybe I can put it in this deal. Like, you have a young lady or a woman that's extremely attractive. Like, most humans would say, hey, this man or lady is extremely attractive. And you know that, okay, but this particular lady is always reaching out to the average looking guy. She's always just constantly texting and calling this guy. It's like, man, and she's just doing that out of the blue. So it's kind of like, you know, typically, you know, mm-hmm. guys approach you. So why are you constantly hitting me up? It's just a red flag. It's just kind of like, what is
something to look into? Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, well, hold on, man. Let me figure out what's kind of going on there, because that's kind of out of the ordinary. Typically, when you have a lot of people recruiting you, you don't really reach out to people. So that's just kind of a red flag there. So what's really going on there?
So it could be a sign that they've been turned down by other teams.
Correct. Correct. That means that he's really been turned down. He's got some grade issues. He's got something there that could be. Or, I mean, it just could be, he could love recruiting and he's not serious about football. Some people love recruiting more than they love playing the game of football. You know, they love attention, right? Mm-hmm. They just want the ability to tweet out, hey, I got this other school that offered me a scholarship. So their friends can go like it. So it's just all those things that you kind of have to sort through as a football coach, for sure.
Yeah, I guess it's like in anything like dating or job seeking, it's like you don't want to come across as too needy or give away indicators that you've been overlooked by other people and stuff like that. Yeah.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Any other red flags come to mind that you care to talk about in the recruiting space?
Just how you communicate to coaches. Is he rude? Is he dismissive? Things like that, man. I mean, that's just the common courtesy things like that that you kind of look for when you bring him up on a visit. How does he treat the recruiting girls when he's up here and the people that are helping get him from point A to point B? Little things like that you're constantly looking for and evaluating personalities and things of that nature.
It must be so hard to predict how people will react to, you know, once they're on a team, and especially if they get attention and they're sort of a celebrity on the team. I mean, I've always thought about how kind of deranging being famous would be, and it seems like it's really hard to predict how people will react to that, whether they'll kind of crumble under the pressure or else kind of become narcissistic and behave in other different bad ways. So it just must be really hard to predict how people will react.
Yeah, it is very, very hard to predict. Some guys handle it well. Some guys don't handle the pressure as well. Some guys become a little bit more arrogant, and some, you know, fall in love with, like I said, some fall in love with Instagram and they just want to post pictures and things like that. So, yeah, I mean, it is very, very difficult to predict how people will react once they get into in the spotlight, because, you know, especially like at major universities, and we're really good university too. But when you get to, I mean, LSU, if you're a star player on LSU or you're on the LSU football team, I mean, you're kind of in the spotlight, so to speak, or any Ohio State, Miami, any Texas, I mean, any of those major schools, man. And once you get in the spotlight and everybody telling you how cool you are and all that stuff, so how do you kind of handle all of that? I mean, that is very difficult to predict, because most kids, when they come into college, how old are they? 19, 20 years old. So trying to predict how a 19, 20 year old will handle pressure. Mm-hmm. Good luck to you.
Yeah. a lot of chaos in that. Yeah.
Potentially. It's
tough endeavor. Yeah. So, yeah, we've covered a lot of interesting stuff. Is there anything you want to talk about, whether that's behavior related things or if you just want to go to talk about, you know, what your projects are, maybe your book or anything you're working on now?
Well, I mean, probably the main thing is, Zach, I'm thankful that you took out the time, man, to speak with me a little bit. And I was very excited for this opportunity. And so I appreciate it, man. You're doing great work. And I'm also, you know, like I said, I'm working on I did publish the Recruits Playbook, and it's designed for high school student athletes to understand the recruiting process and how to get themselves recruited and what to and what not to do. And, you know, that's kind of where my passion is with young men and helping people out. Probably the number one thing is that I would like for people to get from my book is the ability to overcome, you know, adversity, to learn how to just wherever you are in from a behavior standpoint is to you have to know that you don't have to stay there, that you can use difficulties to help you grow and strengthen your behavior to become the individual that you want to be. And I think we were talking about that earlier. Is that something that you can develop? Absolutely. I do think that it's something that you can develop, and you may not be there right now, but if you just stay in the fight or you continue to put yourself out there, learn and grow, I think the sky's the limit for any area that anybody wants to go into, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you had asked me that earlier, and I should say, yeah, I do believe it is something you can grow, you know, the mental toughness for sure. I believe is something you can develop. It might be harder for some people than others, depending on, you know, upbringing or you know, biology or whatever it is, you know, it's these unknown factors, but I definitely do believe it is something you can grow and get better at and overcome a lot of stuff. Yeah, for sure. I was wondering, one thing I wondered while we're on that subject is how often, considering the stresses of being a professional athlete, especially when you're young, is it pretty common that people get, you know, counseling, get a therapist? And if that is common, does it have a stigma around it? Do people talk openly about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that nowadays it's becoming really popular. You know, I know that the NFL offers free counseling for guys to utilize that. And I know that player development, like a lot of teams now have player development. They have things around to help the guys and help the men to talk and to let out, you know, to be able to have an area or a space to get their frustrations out, especially with these high stress jobs. And I mean, just kind of where, you know, society is now, man, there's a lot of things kind of going on, and people really need those outlets to kind of discuss those frustrations. But I don't think that there is a negative stigma to it now. There may have been, you know, 10, 15 years ago, but now, man, it's not negative at all. People are like, hey, you got to get counseling, or if you need somebody mm-hmm. to talk to, man, go get it.
That's good. Yeah, that's nice.
Absolutely.
All right, Larry, this has been great. Yeah, thanks a lot for coming on, and I appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, man. Thank you so much, Zach, and you have a good one, man. Take care.
That was University of Houston football coach Larry Hart, author of the book, The Recruit's Playbook. You can follow him on Twitter at Coach Larry Hart. If you like this talk, just a reminder about the other sports-related episodes of my podcast, which you can find at behavior-podcast.com. I'm Zach Elwood, and if you're interested in my PokerTales work, you can find that at my PokerTales site, readingpokertales.com. If you enjoy this podcast and want to encourage me to work on it more, please share episodes with your friends and family. Thanks for listening. Music by Small Skies.